This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Coronavirus on the rise again in Spain. Local governments are trying to halt the spread and sending mixed messages to foreign tourists.
Catalonia is a safe and friendly destination for national and international visitors alike.
And a year after the Walmart tragedy, people in El Paso continue to face the problems that led to it.
The violence that created the attack in El Paso is still very well alive.
Also today, Australia's deadly bushfires were made worse by climate change. Now a 23-year-old law student is suing her government for failing to confront the challenges.
Starts telling the truth and acting with honesty around this issue because it's going to affect all of us.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A year ago today, tragedy in El Paso, Texas. A gunman opened fire at a busy Walmart, killing 23 people. Dozens others wounded.
Jorge Calvillo Garcia. Leonardo Campos Jr.
Today, the victims were remembered at a service in El Paso. Bishop Mark Seitz of the Diocese of El Paso also spoke.
Someone tried to divide us, and here we are. Someone tried to take away our hope, and here we are.
Authorities have charged Patrick Crucius with 23 counts of hate crimes and capital murder. Prior to the mass shooting, he had posted a rant online saying he wanted to kill as many Latino people as possible. Crucius has pled not guilty. It is a painful day for people in El Paso. Fernando Garcia is the executive director of the Border Network for Human Rights, an immigration advocacy group based in El Paso.
For us, there were three evils that came together. The first one was the weapons of war in our streets. I mean, there's a major problem with the weapons being accessible for people that shouldn't have these kind of weapons. Secondly, what we call white supremacy. We believe that there was a resurgence of white supremacy in the last 2 years, 3 years. And finally, the final element that actually fueled the attack was the narrative of Mr. Trump. I mean, he called Mexicans rapists, criminals, an infestation. So those elements created the conditions for the attack on Walmart to happen.
Today, how is the city of El Paso doing? What's your assessment a year on?
At the community level, it's still an open wound that has not healed. Obviously, it's not going to be healed until we find justice. And I think that is very important.
Representative Veronica Escobar, a Democratic congresswoman from El Paso, she said an attack on Latinos like the one that happened a year ago is something she was long worried about. Are you concerned it could happen again, Fernando?
Yes. The basic conditions for that attack to happen, they are still out there. I mean, they have not changed. In some cases, they have it intensified. I mean, if you see the emergence of Black Lives Matters, and it shows you that hate and xenophobia and racism is still alive.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, since the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May, there's been an urgent outpouring of solidarity among people of color and for people of color. This country's at a moment, a crossroads, where these movements are happening at once. I'm wondering how the tragedy in El Paso a year ago has been affected by this new energy.
Unfortunately, a year ago, even though we had 23 people killed and many more injured, there was not a larger national movement. There was not an outcry to actually confront white supremacy and racism. But I believe that Black Lives Matter has a potent tool to connect people and to connect struggles. I think it gave us more clarity that the road ahead of us is going to imply that we need to come together to actually fight these institutional evils.
I know that social distancing measures, Fernando, are taking place at today's events in El Paso, but how has the COVID-19 pandemic impacted your community's ability to come together and support each other over the past few months?
Oh, yeah, well, that is indeed a major issue. But in the case of what we're going to do today, we're going to be wearing masks and we're going to have sanitizer, gloves, face shields, everything possible so we can do this safely. We didn't want to let this opportunity go to actually come and call it what it is. I mean, if we don't call it what it is, if we don't name it what it is, and what happened before could happen again.
So what is the message and the narrative you want to express to everyone present or not at today's commemoration of the tragedy in El Paso? Not just your community, but beyond.
Yeah. For us, our hearts, our minds, they go to our victims. I mean, and to the families of our victims. But what we want to also say to the nation is that this was not an attack against some families. This was an attack against a community. In this case, a community that is being resilient, a community that I'm proud of being part of. So that is the message. But also along with that is we want the nation to not to forget. We want the nation to be aware that what happened in El Paso, it could happen elsewhere because the conditions are still there. The ideology is still there. And the violence that created the attack in El Paso is still very well alive.
Fernando Garcia, the executive director of the immigration advocacy group, the Border Network for Human Rights, speaking with us from El Paso, Texas. Fernando, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
In Spain, cases of the coronavirus are once again ticking upward. 2,000 to 3,000 cases now being reported each day. This is happening just 1 month after Spain's nationwide lockdown ended. Regional Spanish governments are actively trying to contain the virus again, doing things like making masks mandatory and shutting down nightclubs. But as Lucia Benavides reports from Barcelona, these measures are problematic coming at the height of tourist season.
Barcelona Sagrada Familia has never been this empty. A little kid rides his scooter in the pedestrian street in front of the Basilica, which in previous years would have been impossible with the hundreds of tourists flocking around it and taking photos. Today, the street is filled with residents walking their dogs, jogging, or playing with their children. Francesc Guasch brought his 3 sons today. He says they're taking advantage of an empty Barcelona as much as they can. But he's also wary that few tourists mean many people are left without jobs. He worries about the economic impact, especially since countries like the UK, Germany, and France, who make up a large number of visitors in Spain, have discouraged travel here. It's logical, he says, that they would tell people not to come if there's a risk of getting infected. Spain is experiencing what some are calling a possible second wave of the pandemic. And the northeast region of Catalonia, which includes Barcelona, is one of the areas with the highest number of outbreaks. Spain was particularly hard hit when the coronavirus first arrived in Europe in February. But after a strict 3-month lockdown that began mid-March, the number of new cases was brought down to a trickle. But since confinement measures were lifted, people began to relax, and some tourists began to arrive. In an attempt to contain the virus, Catalan President Quim Torra urged people to act responsibly or else face a possible new confinement.
L'increment dels rebrots i de les dades de persones contagiades és...
Speaking in Catalan, Torra said the situation is critical and very worrying. But then he directed his speech towards international viewers, in English, saying that the situation is being closely monitored.
Catalonia is definitely a safe and friendly destination for national and international visitors alike.
These mixed messages are being heard often as politicians try to salvage what's left of this year's tourist season. Tourism accounts for 12% of the country's GDP and was at a standstill for months due to the pandemic. Last week, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez responded to the UK's decision to impose a mandatory quarantine for those returning from Spain. He called the measure unjust, but by contrast, Spain's health emergency chief Fernando Simón said the measure is sensible considering the situation. Back at Sagrada Familia, kids continue to enjoy the fairly empty streets. Roxana Arevalo is here with her son. She takes photos of him in front of the basilica. Arevalo says what worries her the most about the recent outbreaks is the city's nightlife.
Me sabe mal porque es lo que tal vez da más dinero.
She recognizes it brings in a lot of money, but says local governments should have waited longer to reopen nightclubs and dance halls, which were once again ordered shut in Barcelona last week. And she says financial support from the government isn't enough. They need to be creating jobs that don't necessarily depend on tourism.
Es que todo es una cadena.
Arevalo says it's all connected. Those who aren't working also aren't spending, which affects the overall economy. She says for now, things are okay because people are living off of their savings. But she worries about how things will be come autumn. For The World, Lucia Benavides, Barcelona.
Just a few months ago, as you'll remember, Australia was battling record heat, drought, and massive deadly bushfires. Many activists and scientists there have been drawing connections between the devastating fires and climate change and criticizing the Australian government for not taking enough action. Now they're suing the government. 23-year-old law student Cata O'Donnell is leading a class action lawsuit, accusing her country for failing to disclose the financial risks from climate change. It's believed to be the first time that a climate case like this has been brought against a nation's government. Cata O'Donnell joins us now from Melbourne. When did you first decide, Cata, you wanted to sue the government?
Well, I decided this year, but I can't remember a time when climate change wasn't a concern to me. I think it really was the Black Summer bushfires that we've just had this past summer that it really was a point where I thought we can't keep going like this.
I mean, you chose a pretty unusual legal argument. You are accusing the Australian government of failing to disclose the material risks of climate change to people investing in government bonds. So why focus on the financial investment risks of climate change?
Climate change is going to be expensive. The recent fires that we've had here have been estimated to cost our economy over $100 billion. Severe weather events are going to cost our economy a lot, and it's going to impact the value of government bonds.
So what you're saying essentially is that the Australian government issuing bonds, basically they're asking people to invest in government projects and that they'll be sound. And you're saying, look at these fires, how can the government kind of stand by this claim? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And the bonds that I hold mature in 2050. So by that time, science tells us that we're going to be living in a very different world, one that is frequented with severe weather events. And it's going to really impact our society and our economy.
A report in March said that the devastating fires in Australia that happened this past year were 30% more likely to occur because of climate change. Do bushfires show up in your lawsuit? And how do you kind of make the connection?
Yeah, the physical impacts of climate change do show up in the case. But to me, it's a really personal issue because I live in an area that's been devastated by two very large bushfires. And that just makes all of what I read about climate change much more tangible. I'm terrified of a future where these are common occurrences.
So what exactly are you asking for in the lawsuit?
We're asking for the government to disclose climate change as a material risk when it's issuing government bonds. And if the government does have to disclose the risks of climate change, the flow-on effects from this would be that they need to make their bonds less risky by taking stronger action to fight climate change.
Cata, my understanding is that a majority of Australians support action on climate change, although we should point out that Australia, like the US, is pretty polarized politically on climate change. Even many high-profile climate denialists are in Australia's federal government. So what's been the response to your lawsuit?
The amount of attention that this has already had, I think, really highlights how much of an issue this is to so many people. It's really relevant to people right now. People are really concerned about this issue.
Kata O'Donnell is a law student at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, and leading a class action lawsuit against the government of her home country of Australia. Thanks very much for being with us, Kata. Good luck.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. This has probably happened to you before. You read something online about the pandemic that seems outrageous. You ignore it. Next thing you know, you hear someone casually talking about it like it's a scientific fact. Vish Viswanathan knows about this chain of disinformation. He's a professor of health communication at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Professor, it's been more than 5 months since the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S. in a big way. What have you seen with how disinformation has evolved since it started?
I think clearly there has been an increase in disinformation because obviously social media, but also because the uncertainty around how to control it, the lack of a vaccine, absence of an effective treatment, has only created that uncertainty where people are trying to fill in the gaps. So that's one reason. A second reason, which is very interesting, unlike in past pandemics, the spread of misinformation is now aided and abetted by amplification through voices of political authorities.
So just to be clear, we're talking disinformation, intentionally confusing claims about the coronavirus. We may also talk about misinformation, which is misunderstanding that just catches on. As for disinformation, what is the motive of anyone who would be sowing it about the virus?
There is an advantage that certain people can gain by seeding doubts of uncertainty and creating political divides in a country. Some studies have shown that it could be state actors. Primarily, you know, Russia could be one of them, or China, Iran. But it is very difficult to ascertain with any great deal of certitude. There are also non-state actors who are spreading this disinformation, even within the U.S. or maybe outside the U.S., such as conspiracy theories. I'm sure your listeners must have heard of, say, QAnon as one example.
QAnon.
Yeah, who have been also very active in this field.
Can you give us an example of a disinformation campaign during this pandemic that you would say was successful? Like, how did it work and what was the impact?
The most obvious one would be increasing attention. Despite all the scientific evidence, the value of hydroxychloroquine or malaria medication continues to be articulated, right? And that's a great example where it's not misinformation because it has been clarified very clearly that the medication is not effective. Yet it keeps coming up actively. Second example is I have seen videos where state actors have been blamed for certain actions. Now, for example, the Chinese government has been accused of spreading it actively to control its citizens and actively kill them. And of course, there have been also conspiracies against CIA as another actor benefiting from it.
Hydroxychloroquine is a great example, and the claim of its benefits, as you say, Vish, do not go away, despite the claim being debunked by experts. Why is it so challenging to identify disinformation and misinformation and to talk with others about it?
Increasingly, because of the saturation coverage in the media and the penetration of social media, the boundaries between what is credible platform versus what is not a credible platform has become blurred. So one example, so I can see a disinforming tweet, let me put it that way, but immediately, even while it is being debunked, it might be covered in the mainstream media. And particularly if a political actor picks up the tweet and says something about it, then media are compelled. You know, you don't have a choice because it's a very authoritative political figure who's repeating that false information. So then you are forced to cover the story, even if you flag it. You know, these are the reasons why we are finding it so difficult to control them as they keep spreading.
I'm speaking with Vish Vishwanath. He's a professor of health communication at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. We're talking about disinformation and misinformation during the pandemic. Professor, what do you do when you hear someone rattle off something about COVID that you just know is patently wrong? Do you correct politely?
There are two groups of people out there. So there are groups of people who are genuinely disinformed, who are trying to make sense of it. To people like that, I generally guide them to some trusted sources. It could be CDC, it could be WHO. So I guide them there if they are genuinely misinformed or disinformed and they want more information. But it is a second group where persuasion or education is unlikely to work because they're already convinced about a conspiracy. There's not a lot you can do because the more you try to talk to them, the more likely you'll reinforce their opinion or their beliefs.
Looking ahead, there is cautious optimism that there's going to be an effective vaccine. That could really be a game changer. How worried are you, though, by the prospect of disinformation around vaccines? And specifically, what are you worried about?
People are already circling around it, you know, the anti-vaccine forces. We have made tremendous progress thanks to the contribution of scientists and government officials and others. But remember, typically a vaccine development takes a number of years, and we are trying to do all of it in a short period of time. And the question is, how effective and safe is this vaccine? The reason I'm worried about that part is that also leads to the communications around that vaccine. We need to really prepare people on when this vaccination is available. Not everybody will get the vaccine right away. We will need hundreds of millions of doses, if not billions, and people have to wait their turn. So there will be a big debate who should get it first, and there will be controversy around that. Second issue is a misinformation. Already they have begun. People are questioning the vaccines, and people are saying that, you know, this is a part of a conspiracy to promote vaccination. And so we need to be prepared ahead of time that there will be a lot more misinformation around this vaccine. Even a small problem could be amplified and magnified by the anti-vaccine forces and others, and we need to be prepared for that.
What do you think are the most effective ways for large organizations and governments to push back against disinformation?
Large organizations and governments have been very reactive and not very proactive when it comes to misinformation and disinformation, especially around vaccination. When the science is on our side, on the right side, I think it's very critical to have a plan in place by being completely transparent and open about vaccines and other issues, whether it is safety, whether it is efficacy. You have to be open. You have to be honest. Because public health communications in these kinds of situations depends on transparency, trust, and credibility. And it's important to be out there being very open about it.
Vish Vishwanath is a professor of health communication at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, speaking with us about coronavirus disinformation and misinformation. Professor, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stories and reporting that combat disinformation, that's what you get from us every day here at The World. For one more dose of reliable information from us, sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, delivered right to your email inbox first thing in the morning so you can start your day informed. Just head to theworld.org/newsletters. In Canada, they're turning a blind eye to this kind of behavior in public spaces.
I'm having white wine. Would you like some?
Because drinking together can be good for you. Emotionally, say the experts, it's better than cocktails by yourself.
The last thing I want is for months upon months is people inside drinking on their own.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. An attack on a prison complex in eastern Afghanistan began last night with a car bomb. Gunfire continued well into today. At least 24 people were killed. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, the brazen assault in Jalalabad raises questions about the prospects for peace and security in Afghanistan.
The sound of celebration in the streets of Jalalabad today as Afghan security forces wrapped up their operation. Afghan Army General Yasin Zia reassured the crowd that the fighting was over and that the prison was now secure. The enemies of the Afghan people carried out an attack on this prison complex last night, he said. And the operation took longer than expected because civilians were trapped in nearby residential buildings. Jalalabad is one of Afghanistan's biggest cities. It's not far from the Pakistan border and has long been an Islamic State stronghold. Fawad Aman is a spokesperson with Afghanistan's Ministry of Defense. I reached him shortly after he'd visited the scene in Jalalabad. He said in the past few years, Afghan government forces have been successful at weakening the network of ISIS fighters in the area.
They can't fight with Afghan forces face to face. Their operation, their activity in Afghanistan has been restrained.
That's why, he says, they resort to suicide attacks and car bombs. Still, jailbreaks are a hallmark of the so-called Islamic State, which claimed responsibility for this latest incident. The group carried out similar attacks in Iraq in the early 2000s. Its fighters helped release hundreds of Al-Qaeda prisoners who went on to form the group now known as ISIS. News reports about the attack on the jail in Jalalabad says that hundreds of prisoners managed to escape. Fawad Aman didn't deny these reports.
They will be captured soon.
The timing of this attack is not a coincidence, says Scott Warden with the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington. He says the U.S. and the Taliban have been negotiating a peace deal. The next step in the peace process is for the Afghan government and the Taliban to sit down for negotiations.
We've seen high-profile attacks at key moments in the peace process that appear to be designed to derail it. And there are a lot of militants and terrorist groups like the Islamic State who would prefer to continue the war.
Warden says when there are spectacular attacks like this one, it is harder for the Afghan government to talk about peace.
Because the Afghan public feels like they're under assault. And so this violence, even though it comes from non-Taliban organizations, reduces the confidence and the support that the Afghans will have for trying to enter into a peace process.
The Taliban and the Afghan government agreed on a short temporary ceasefire last week. But now there are questions about the future of the talks. Kabul-based security analyst Habib Wardak says over the past 2 years, the Afghan government has gone out of its way to say it has ISIS under control. But the prison incident suggests that ISIS is not under control and that Afghanistan is dealing with multiple threats.
It's passing on a message that a deal with the Taliban will not ensure peace in Afghanistan because you have other elements in Afghanistan which also possesses threat to a long-term sustainable peace in Afghanistan.
Still, Scott Warden of the U.S. Institute of Peace thinks that the talks should continue.
The Islamic State will try to spoil the process with attacks. And if you use that as a reason to delay talks, then in some ways it gives a victory to the Islamic State.
The next step in the negotiations is the release of hundreds of Taliban prisoners. The Afghan government has been slow to follow through on this because some of the prisoners have blood on their hands. President Trump has made the peace deal and the withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan a major campaign promise. The events in Jalalabad show just how complicated the situation is. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Hundreds of people gathered in Portland, Oregon this weekend, marching in support of Black Lives Matter. Federal officers were no longer there. The Trump administration and Oregon's Democratic governor reached an agreement last week to draw down the federal presence in Portland. But a big question remains, why were Border Patrol agents even there in the first place? Kelly Lytle-Hernandez is a professor of history at UCLA. She's the author of several books, including Migra, A History of the U.S. Border Patrol. So Customs and Border Protection agents are primarily responsible for, as the name implies, border security. Is it appropriate, Kelly, for them to be in a city like Portland?
You ask a good question, and there's actually a fairly long history of Border Patrol officers being sent to address federal concerns across the country. And we can date this all the way back to the civil rights era when there were uprisings happening across the country. Border Patrol was sent out to manage and squash and facilitate the federal government's position on those uprisings. The second point is that Many people don't understand, but the U.S. Border Patrol claims jurisdiction 100 miles within any land or sea border in the United States, which encompasses two-thirds of the U.S. population, nearly 200 million people, and most major cities, New York, Los Angeles, and so on, and the entire state of Florida. So this is an area that is within Border Patrol jurisdiction. It's not just formally the U.S.-Canadian or U.S.-Mexican border.
On one hand, Washington said these agents were in cities like Portland, Chicago, and Kansas City to help with police investigations. Homicides were at the top of the list in this case. Is CPB even equipped to assist with those kinds of investigations, though?
No, they're not trained in this area, certainly. They are largely trained in immigration control. And so that would not be the skill set that they're bringing. We also heard that they were being sent to protect federal property in Portland. And again, this is really not what they're trained to do.
Professor, let's talk about this elite Border Patrol unit called BORTAC, the Border Patrol Tactical Unit. It's kind of a special operations unit of CPB, and it was deployed to Portland. What role has BORTAC historically played within the agency?
BORTAC is effectively the Border Patrol's SWAT team. And so they have been utilized in intensive operations around immigration control, human smuggling, and or drug smuggling. So they're really trained to go out and engage in aggressive law enforcement tactics. And it's unsurprising that the tactics that they utilize were quite alarming to many people on the ground.
So if those CBP agents are allowed to operate in U.S. cities, 100 miles from a border zone, if they are redeployed into U.S. cities, I mean, would they have any role?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things to understand about this 100-mile border zone is that within it, there are limited Fourth Amendment protections against search and seizure, unwarranted search and seizure. So long as Border Patrol agents are investigating what they call to be immigration crimes or violations, they're allowed to compromise Fourth Amendment rights of the people that they stop. And so if they then have reasonable suspicion once they stop you of other federal crimes, that is all legitimate police practice within the domain of CBP. And so there's great capacity here for federal law enforcement to be used in a variety of ways to suppress political mobilizations and other activity. So I think we all need to be deeply concerned about this new day that has opened with CBP being sent into our communities, especially those of us who are brown and considered to be undocumented.
Kelly Lytle Hernandez is a historian at UCLA. Professor, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Number one place in the world where Filipino expats are living, the United States. In second place, Saudi Arabia. Roughly 1 million Filipinos live and work in the kingdom, but the pandemic has put many of those Filipino migrant workers in Saudi Arabia in a terrible bind. As the world's Patrick Wynn reports, some of these workers are going online to call attention to their plight.
Rooting through a dumpster under a very hot sun in Saudi Arabia. These men are scavenging for food in a video they posted to Facebook. They came to the Middle East as technicians, construction workers, skilled labor, to make money and send it back home to the Philippines. But then COVID-19 hit. They get let go from their jobs and left to fend for themselves.
They were left with really nothing. So they were forced to rummage through garbage. They were looking for vegetables that were still good enough to eat.
That's Joanna Concepcion with Migrante International, an alliance focused on the rights of Filipino migrant workers. Concepcion first saw this video more than a month ago. Videos like this of Filipinos in Saudi Arabia scavenging for food, they have since gone viral and made a lot of Filipinos upset.
It's really heartbreaking. Heartbreaking and not surprising.
At any given time, there are about 12 million Filipinos working in foreign countries. And more than half are actually in the Middle East, mostly Saudi Arabia. Go get coffee in Saudi Arabia, the barista is likely to be Filipino. Same goes if you hire a nanny, hire some guys to build a condo, or get lunch at Burger King. Saudi Arabia really rests on the shoulders of Filipinos.
The migrant workers have really been the backbone of the economy.
And yet, Concepcion says, a lot of them are feeling pretty disposable right now. Many workers have been fired during the pandemic and just abandoned. They're stuck living in cramped dorms, no cash for food, no cash to fly home. So even engineers with college degrees, they've done a little dumpster diving, and they are trying to tell their story to the media back in the Philippines.
Yan, kamatis!
Pero dahil sa lockdown, bunsod ng COVID-19 pandemic, hirap na sila ngayon.
Ano, kita mo?
You'd think the Philippine government would be irate, but their officials have actually lashed out at the workers. The Philippine ambassador to Saudi Arabia tweeted that guys filming dumpster diving are just, quote, resorting to theatrics to catch attention. Joanna Concepcion from Migrante International, which has spoken directly to some of these stranded workers, says that is really not the case.
The video is definitely real. Many of our government officials here in the Philippines have told them to stop posting those videos and have said they're looking for media attention, but they are facing extreme hunger.
The Philippine government has handed out some food to these workers. There are thousands of them without work. But Migrante International says it's clearly not enough. On top of hunger, a fair number of Filipinos have died from the coronavirus in Saudi Arabia, 150 at least. Concepcion says the workers, stuck all day in hot, stuffy dorms, they are terrified of getting it too.
As long as they remain stranded in their work camps, you know, their survival, right, their health and their livelihood are at stake.
Honestly, there's little sign that the Saudi government plans to make life more tolerable for the Filipinos who work there. Same goes for Qatar, Kuwait, and major cities like Dubai. And Concepcion says this is hardly the first time a crisis hits the Middle East and Filipinos have to go into survival mode.
Filipino migrant workers have been caught in wars of aggression by the U.S. They are the last ones to receive any form of assistance.
But the main difference between now and decades past, workers can at least document their conditions on social media. They're now hoping that these videos pressure the Philippine government to charter flights and bring them back home. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Stay at home, wear a mask, stand 6 feet apart. It's starting to be second nature for many of us, but banning booze? That could be the deal breaker of risk mitigation strategies. Some parts of the world are going that route. The thinking goes that under the influence, you're more likely not to take those other precautions I mentioned. Then there's Canada's approach. From Toronto, here's Anita Elash.
On a steamy Friday night, Trinity Bellwoods Park in downtown Toronto is the place to be. It's always been a favorite spot for summer picnics and social gatherings. What's new this year is the alcohol. Bader Rahm is here for a birthday party with about 20 friends and plenty of wine, beer, and mixed drinks.
I'm having white wine. Would you like some?
Rahm says he'd normally be enjoying drinks at a bar, but most bars in Toronto have been closed for weeks, and even the ones with outdoor patios, he says, just aren't as much fun as they used to be.
Because there's too many restrictions on patios. You can only be like 6 people at once. You can't change seats. So if you sit.
Technically speaking, drinking in public places in Toronto is illegal. But this year, police have agreed to turn a blind eye as long as no one's making trouble. Other Canadian municipalities have gone even further. The city of North Vancouver set aside 9 parks as alcohol-friendly zones. Mayor Linda Buchanan sees it as a positive mental health initiative. Most of North Vancouver's residents live in apartments without access to a garden or yard.
The last thing I want is for months upon months is people inside these very small spaces, socially perhaps alone and isolated, and maybe, you know, drinking on their own for long periods of time.
After months of staying home to help flatten the coronavirus curve, North Vancouverites were getting antsy. Buchanan says the new bylaw for public parks has helped with that. It encourages people to get outside and gives them a place to socialize where it's easy to respect rules on social distancing.
We're not increasing access to alcohol. It's basically giving people a different space.
She sees economic benefits here, too. For example, it's now okay for restaurants and bars in British Columbia to sell takeout wine and beer. Buchanan says that's meant to give the hospitality industry a boost by attracting customers who might stay away because they're not comfortable dining indoors. Sounds like a win-win, right? Well, Tim Stockwell isn't buying it.
I'm used to hearing these narratives all the time that for normal life to continue, we have to be drinking alcohol in parks. It's nonsense.
Stockwell is director of the Canadian Institute for Substance Abuse Research. He says people are forgetting about all the health risks that come with drinking alcohol. That includes risks to public safety, an increased risk of pneumonia, more domestic violence, and more heart attacks. And then, he argues, drinking could even fuel the spread of the coronavirus.
When people are drinking, there are special concerns. They're really, really bad when they're under the influence of social distancing. They're really bad at remembering to take precautions about touching things and cleaning things, touching their face and so forth.
In the first 3 months of the pandemic, alcohol consumption in Canada went up by 10%. And that was before people were allowed to drink in parks. Experts like Stockwell worry the trend might continue. Back at Trinity Bellwoods Park, even some of the drinkers seem less than completely comfortable with their new freedom to imbibe in public.
I know, I don't want to get in trouble with my work. I'm really sorry.
When I approach this law student, who gives her name as Samantha, she hides her bottle under a tote bag.
Hypothetically, we could agree to the fact that we might be drinking at a park.
But she tells me she's concerned that admitting to drinking wine in the park could affect her career. She says mainly she's here to socialize, and being outdoors seems like the best option.
I think it is a better way to handle what's going on in light of the pandemic. It's a balancing of things. You can't kind of like eliminate all options of fun and revelry for people. So if we can do it responsibly, then why not?
That seems to be what Canadian authorities are thinking too, at least for the time being. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Mexico holds the third position on the list of nations with the most deaths from the coronavirus. It's topped only by the U.S. and Brazil. Like everywhere, though, the pandemic is badly hitting the Mexican economy. Mexico's president has ordered deep cuts to a number of public programs, and yet some controversial projects remain intact. Reporter Shannon Young has more from Oaxaca in southern Mexico.
In the capital of Oaxaca, the plaza of the landmark Santo Domingo Church is normally bustling with tourists, but it's cordoned off now with yellow police tape to discourage people from gathering. The plaza also houses the state's largest museum, run by the National Institute for Anthropology and History, also known by its acronym, INAH. It's the guardian of Mexico's cultural history and artifacts, ranging from the prehistoric to the modern. Since March, the museums and archaeological sites that INAH runs have been closed because of the virus. It's uncertain when they'll reopen. The institute is facing deep budget cuts.
It's catastrophic because...
Gilberto López y Rivas is a veteran anthropologist with INAH. He says the cuts are catastrophic and have serious consequences for archaeology, historic conservation, and linguistics programs. Some fear weakening INAH could lead to looting at ancient sites. But the INAH is just one of several government agencies hit by a presidential decree that has slashed their budgets by 75%. The cuts have also gutted environmental, cultural, science and arts programs, along with government bodies for women and indigenous peoples.
Entonces, esta es la gran sorpresa de la Cuarta Transformación.
López y Rivas says the big surprise is that cuts like these come from a government that rode to power on a wave of leftist sentiment and is now seen favoring a continuation of policies that concentrate wealth in the hands of the politically connected few. López y Rivas points to what's been left off the chopping block, big ticket projects, including a new Mexico City airport, a massive oil refinery, and a tourist train circuit in the Yucatan Peninsula. Critics point out that many of the contracts for the projects are going to foreign firms or companies linked to Mexico's richest men, including multi-billionaire Carlos Slim. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador was in Oaxaca recently to cut the ribbon on a port expansion he considers a spending priority. It's part of a massive project known as the Trans-Isthmus Corridor.
Es comunicar a los dos oceanos.
The president, known as AMLO for short, says the corridor will connect the Pacific and Gulf coasts across Mexico's narrowest point, the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. He compares it to a Panama Canal across dry land because a railway will carry shipping containers between ports. A highway is also slated to run parallel to the tracks, along with an oil pipeline and 10 industrial parks. UMLO defends the project as a way to create thousands of jobs and close the economic gap between Mexico's industrialized north and its cash-poor agricultural south.
Se tiene que tener este nuevo puerto a más tardar en 3 años.
AMLO wants the Trans-Isthmus Corridor completed within 3 years and says that protests won't delay it. But he's not the first president to float the idea for this massive infrastructure project.
Este megaproyecto tiene una historia.
Bettina Cruz is with the Oaxacan Assembly in Defense of Land and Territory, an indigenous-led group. Cruz says this canal-style project has been proposed off and on since the mid-19th century.
Sino es un proyecto que viene a despojarnos, a desplazarnos, a robarnos, a quitarnos lo que tenemos.
Cruz says the project has long faced opposition because it would pillage the environment, uproot indigenous communities, and reduce residents to a source of cheap labor, while corporations profit. But organizing protests against it is tough during a pandemic. Plus, some see the megaproject as bringing economic stability. That's hard to argue against right now. The current push for it might work, especially because President López Obrador has both public support and an overwhelming majority in Congress. This worries Cruz.
Estos proyectos no es solo, sino es todo un...
Cruz says, in all, the infrastructure projects that are getting a green light don't just represent new roads, oil refineries, and a railway. They represent a territorial reordering of Mexico's south. For The World, I'm Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico.
Every day, the coronavirus crisis is setting grim records. Here at The World, we're on top of the pandemic, daily on the radio. Because there is a lot of news to bring you, we've also got additional coverage online and live webcasts with experts from Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Recently, we took a deep dive into COVID-19's disproportionate impact on communities of color. Harvard's Nancy Krieger told us the pandemic has shaken public health at its core and exposed systemic racism.
All these things have come together, crashing in on COVID-19 at the same time, which is raising these profound questions about what's the point of government anyway, if it's not to protect the people's health.
We've turned these live webcasts into a special edition podcast that you can get when you subscribe to The World wherever you get your podcasts, and let us connect you with the world's leading public health experts. Following the news during a pandemic, in the hot summer, with people divided as never before, you still want to be able to have little moments of joy. That's what this song is. It's called Moment of Joy.
I'm like a cloud, shape-shifting everywhere.
This is from the latest release by the LA psychedelic soul band Chicano Batman. And as much as we need joy, this is the track I want to leave you with today. Wounds is the title. Chicano Batman's lead vocalist Bardo Martinez sings about entering a new reality that's not what you expect.
I woke up from a beautiful dream. It felt so good to see you smiling merrily. But now you're just a memory. Reality's so cruel, leaving me wounded.
Change is hard. That never changes. New music there from Chicano Batman putting the wraps on things for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for making it today. If you need us, we'll be at theworld.org until we're back on your radio. See you here tomorrow.